How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Tolkien wrote an intriguing and often ignored statement about the Lord of the Rings, and if not ignored, this idea is greatly misunderstood. Quote, "The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision. That is why I have not put in, or have cut out, practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices in the imaginary world. For the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism." Tolkien himself described how his faith subtly shaped the themes and moral framework of Middle-earth, even though overt religious references don't appear in the book. This depth of moral and spiritual grounding is precisely what many feel is missing from Amazon's Rings of Power series, which, without this foundation, lacks the same gravitas that makes The Lord of the Rings so profound. So what does this religious foundation mean for the story itself? And why does it resonate so deeply with you and I as readers of J.R.R. Tolkien? Joining me to unpack these questions is John Carswell from the Tolkien Road Podcast, a fellow Tolkien podcaster, someone whose insights I have long admired, and who brings a unique perspective to Tolkien's legacy, as he, like Tolkien, is a believer in Catholicism. John, thank you for wandering Middle-earth with the Lord of the Rings podcast today.
Hey, thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So let's jump right in. What do you think Tolkien meant when he described The Lord of the Rings as fundamentally religious and Catholic?
That is a that is a very loaded question, and something I've thought about very much over the years of doing Tolkien podcasting. I think what Tolkien was trying to communicate there is that. When we read The Lord of the Rings, we're reading something that is it's inescapably grounded, influenced, all of the above by Catholicism. But it was not something that Tolkien set out to do in a direct fashion. What really happened is, I think what happens with most great art, when an artist puts their heart and their soul into creating something beautiful and wonderful, of any artistic variety, it's inevitable that the things that are most important to them are going to come out in that work. I think it's helpful sometimes to contrast Tolkien's good friend C.S. Lewis and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, from his Chronicles of Narnia, with Lord of the Rings here. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for those who aren't aware, many probably are, but for those who aren't aware, it is almost, some would quibble with this, but it's almost allegorical in how it presents certain aspects of the gospel. Aslan, this great and powerful lion, self-sacrifices in order to redeem, this character Edmund, right? And that's supposed to be very strongly draw your attention to the gospel story, right? Christ crucified for the sake of sinners. But in the case of Lord of the Rings, it's not so on the nose, right? It's not so hey, this is what I'm doing right here. And I think that was very intentional on Tolkien's part. So when he says conscious and unconscious distinction, I think what he's saying is, I didn't know I was doing this when I first started writing this story, but as I went back in the inevitable process of editing, really piecing it together, taking all the different parts and putting them together into this finished thing, I discovered that really this came out, this is in there. It's all kind of packed in there. And I will say that for me, as I've gone and read other parts of the Legendarium, beyond Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, the History of Middle-earth series, even non-Middle-earth writings of Tolkien, you really start to understand what he means in all of that. So I hope that helps.
You say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you say that. I love how he feels like he's sort of discovering this. I mean, he as you say, he put his heart, his soul, his all of this effort into his life's work, and inevitably some of that belief system and faith is going to be built into that. But it's not allegory, right? I've been reading the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, and he insists, like almost every other letter, this is not an allegory for anything, not for World War II, not for the Christian story, not for anything. It's just a story, right? Mm-hmm. And the symbolism, and I love how I quoted before, how he says that it's absorbed into the story and the symbolism, and he kind of discovered it as he went. So what elements of the Lord of the Rings do you think absorb this sort of religious or Catholic foundation?
Well, it's all over the place. And one that comes to mind immediately is, I think it is not hard to see once you've identified it out loud, right? And that would simply be the idea that Frodo is, given this mission to carry this ring, right? Which, you know, really carries this strong resonance, or whatever you want to term it, as being the ultimate thing of evil, right? It's this kind of ultimate power that if it gets back into the wrong hands, it could cause, you know, great amounts of evil within Middle Earth. And here he is, this, you know, humble figure who is given this task, somehow chosen for this task, not to do some kind of, direct combat, if you will, but to go really in disguise right into the very heart of darkness, right? Right into the very jaws of death, right into the very jaws of evil, and to deliver evil itself back to where it came from, right? To the ultimate death blow of destruction. When you understand that, and you can kind of draw out the parallels from the gospel, Christ coming into the world, God becoming man, humbling, becoming humble, almost taking on disguise, right, in order to carry out this mission, right? Not to go and become this great king to conquer all of the nations with the sword, because I am the most powerful one, but to really empty himself and to go right into death itself, and to conquer sin and death through his own self-sacrifice. So when you understand that as being this pattern that's contained within the Lord of the Rings, I think it starts to come into focus, you know, just what Tolkien meant. So that's kind of a larger example. There's all kinds of little details too. One that I was refamiliarizing myself with right before I jumped on here with you is when Frodo is with Faramir, and they sit down to eat, and there is this passage where it speaks. I'll just go ahead and read it for you, right?
Yeah, please.
And it says, Faramir says to Frodo, "Is it the custom in your land to wash the head before supper?" said the man who waited on the hobbits. I'm sorry, that's another one of Faramir's men. "No, before breakfast," said Sam. "But if you're short of sleep, cold water on the necks, like rain on a wilted lettuce. There, now I can keep awake long enough to eat a bit." They were led then to seats beside Faramir, barrels covered with pelts and high enough above the benches of the men for their convenience. Before they ate, Faramir and all his men turned and faced west in a moment of silence. Faramir signed to Frodo and Sam that they should do likewise. "So we always do," he said as they sat down. "We look towards Numenor that was, and beyond to Elvenhome that is, and to that which is beyond Elvenhome and will ever be. Have you no such custom at meat?" So right there, we have just this little, and I don't think I noticed this until just a few years ago, like this like tiny little detail, because it's such a like easy thing to gloss over. But Faramir and his men here they're praying, right? They're saying a word of grace before they sit down to eat. And where do they look? And this is what's really interesting to me. They look to the west, towards Numenor that was, right? They're all descendants of Numenor, many thousands of years beyond, but descendants of Numenor. and beyond to Elvenhome that was. And so this would be really the Blessed Realm, right? And even further west than Numenor, and to that which is beyond Elvenhome and will ever be. And so that is this like mysterious idea of like, well, what's beyond Elvenhome and will ever be? Because even the, you know, the elves and the high mortal men of Middle Earth, they know in some sense that there is supposed to be an end to this world, right? There is an end in some distant future time to this world. And so what is this place beyond Elvenhome that will ever be, right? It's little details like this that tell you like there really was something more going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a beautiful example of, shall we say, appointing to some higher power, right? As you look to the West, and the West is the symbol in Middle Earth, as you say, for the Blessed Realm. And that's where the Valar, or the powers that govern Middle Earth, that's where they dwell. They're sort of the creator god Iluvatar. That's where they are his representatives there. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful thing that Faramir and his men continue to have that tradition. It's almost as if they know that there's higher powers beyond them, and mm-hmm. they still have that reverence for them, even if the structure of Gondor is not quite what Numenor was in the Second Age, with its special relationship with Iluvatar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and of course, this is taking place 3,000 years after the fall of Numenor, and still, you know, these descendants of Numenor have this strong sense of this tradition. They remember mm-hmm. Numenor as a distant memory. But really, that may be a good segue, and I don't mean to jump ahead of your schedule necessarily, but I think it's important to highlight Numenor there, because Numenor, I think when you start to understand all of the things that Tolkien wrote about Numenor, you start to understand really a big part of that religious element, right, coming into it. Mm-hmm. While it is true that there isn't any like sort of religious cult or religious practice that is similar to most of the religions that we think of and, you know, in the modern world or in our world as it is, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of like religion as, you know, involving, you know, great churches or temples or this kind of thing with exquisite, you know, or very detailed religious rites and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But for the Numenoreans, they did have a religion, and for all intents and purposes, it seems to have been something that was revealed to them, right? That it was kind of given to them, not something they came up with on their own. And so the story, when we get into the story of Numenor, we learn that when they arrived at the end of the, or at the beginning of the Second Age, at this island shaped like a star that was halfway between the Blessed Realm, the land of immortality, and Middle Earth, they arrive at this island shaped like a star. And what is in the center of this island but this mountain, right? And at the top of this mountain, they develop this, it's almost as if it's, again, instructed that they're going to do this, but there's this mountain with a kind of paved, you know, I can't remember if it's paved or a stairway, but it's, you know, it's basically a mountain that's not like most of the mountains that we try to climb in this world where it's like this arduous journey, but mm-hmm. it's like, it's relatively easy to ascend this mountain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. They get to the top of this mountain, and three times a year, it's a place of complete silence. And three times a year, they're supposed to, the king of Numenor is supposed to offer these prayers, to Eru, right? The one. And, this is really, really interesting. When you kind of start to piece a lot of different aspects of the lore together. For one, the elves had a very close relationship with the Valar, of course. And so, you know, I can pause here, Aaron, and help your audience out if we need to. I know I'm starting to throw out some of the, 50 cent terms when it comes to these things.
No, you're good. So Just a quick reference. The Valar are the powers, the government of Earth. They live in the far, far west. And we've covered that extensively on this podcast. I know John has on his as well. So if you need more info on the Valar, reach out to us and we'll send you a few links. But yeah, the Valar are there and they are essentially demigods, we might say, under the one creator god, the supreme god, Eru Iluvatar. We've thrown out both names. Eru and Iluvatar are both names of the one creator god. So
okay, yeah, fantastic. You've done a great job of educating your audience. So fantastic. I just didn't want to run too far ahead and leave anybody kind of like, what is this Valar, Eru, you know, all this stuff. So, well, fantastic.
Yeah, good. Keep going.
So Eru, so we have this mountain called the Minultarma in the middle of Numenor, and throughout their history, this is the place that the king of Numenor is supposed to lead the people in this prayer three times a year, right? And during this prayer, there will be three eagles, right, that are kind of circling above, almost as if they're overseeing, or perhaps they're carrying. They're like carrying these prayers or something of that nature. They're servants of Manwë, right? Not the creator god, but the greatest of the Valar, kind of the high king of the Valar, the high king of Middle Earth, but under Eru, right? Under the uncreated creator god. But it really appears that Numenor is almost, the people of Numenor are almost chosen not simply to have this land that is halfway between Middle Earth and the Blessed Realm, you know, just kind of barely on the edge of the immortal lands, almost as if they're being teased by it. But it's like they're actually supposed to be drawn to this higher calling beyond even what the elves were drawn to, right? That in a way they are drawn into a relationship directly with Eru Iluvatar for the first time in the history of Middle Earth. And when you start to kind of understand that background, little details like Faramir's prayer that we talked about earlier become, you know, far more significant. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I can continue, but but if you...
I don't want to break up your train of thought, but I think at one point you once mentioned that the calling or relationship of the men of Numenor was almost to be emissaries or missionaries of Eru Iluvatar to the, shall we say, lower men of Middle Earth who did not have that same blessing and responsibility given to them. Talk a little bit about that sort of relationship and responsibility.
Yeah, for sure. So there are details within the various writings on Numenor that indicate that the men who were brought to Numenor, which is again this like the closest thing to an earthly paradise that you can kind of imagine, right? Now, again, the Blessed Realm is terrestrial in this time, like it does exist within, you know, within the world. So, you know, that's like the immortal lands, but Numenor is like supposed to be the closest that a mortal, right, can really get to that sort of blessedness within this world. Okay. But the question is, like, is any of us ever given like great blessing in this world, in this life, just for the sake of enjoying that blessing, right? Enjoying, you know, like just having the good life. And, you know, I think we all probably sense within ourselves, if we're all at all honest with ourselves, we're like, you know, enjoyment of good things is all good, but ultimately there's almost like there's no real way to actually achieve lasting happiness in this world, in this life, right? Not for, you know, any one particular individual. So I think there's detail that is brought out within the stories of Numenor that indicate that this was almost supposed to be like a launching place, right? So like a way to recreate mortal men, to kind of like renew mortal men and to give them a renewed purpose within the world, not just so that they could have it for themselves on the island of Numenor, but so that they could carry it back to all of the men who remained under the shadow, in Middle Earth, right? Their distant cousins who still remained under the shadow. There is a very sort of lesser known work that's in one of the volumes of the History of Middle Earth. That is the short hand for it is just Othrabeth, it's the full title is Athrbeth Fenrada Andreth, which basically means the dialogue between Fenrod and Andreth. And so Fenrod, not sure if you've covered that on your podcast before, Aaron, but Fenrod, as I'm sure you know, he's actually the brother of Galadriel, and a figure that is a very sort of heroic, beautiful souled figure, elvish figure in the First Age. And so he's having this dialogue with this mortal woman, right? So a mortal of the race of men. And they it's kind of a, you know, meandering dialogue, and they're talking about, like, it's really like one kind of one of these meaning of life sorts of conversations. But at one point there's a really beautiful passage where they start to deal with questions of the nature that we've just been talking about. Like what is the point, you know, of men's life on this earth when we're, you know, elves have immortality, right? Like, you can just expect to live forever, assuming that nothing bad happens to you, right? But for men, it's like, maybe I get to live 70 or 80 years if I'm lucky, you know, and then, and then it's over. Of course, this is in the First Age, so there haven't even been the Numenorean lifespan that has come along yet of like 300 or 400 years, right? But at one point, and this is where you really start to see the Catholicism come out very strongly, right? At one point in this dialogue, Andreth says to Fenrod, so they're talking about the idea of like hope and hope beyond this world, right? For men. And Fenrod says, what then was this hope, if you know? Andreth responds, they say that the one will himself enter into Arda and heal men and all the Maring from the beginning to the end. This they say also, or they feign, is a rumor that has come down through years uncounted, even from the days of our undoing. So what is that? Well, that's a, you know, pretty clear prophecy of the incarnation, right? The incarnation of Christ, that God will become man. And that's how ultimately man and the world will be rescued from evil, ultimately. So you have this, like, you know, very clear prophecy, and it's actually going, and this is where you start to understand, like, wait a minute, Tolkien actually intended, like, the history of Middle Earth not to be this like fantasy world necessarily, but to be a very like a myth rooted in our own world, in the ancient history of our own world, if you will. And so it all kind of starts to connect. You piece this together with things he said in On Fairy Stories, and it just all kind of begins to crystallize for you. So that's one of the very strong like sort of background elements of Catholicism that he was drawing out. And remember, Numenor, he was composing that story all while he was writing Lord of the Rings and after it. And then this dialogue here was something that he very much wrote after the Lord of the Rings was published. So he's like, it's almost like he wrote Lord of the Rings. He was like, wow, I didn't mean to, but I just wrote something really Catholic. And then he spent the rest of his life trying to unpack all of the Catholicism stuff in it. So
how do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
My fellow wanderer, we are fast approaching the 200th episode of the Lore of the Rings podcast, and I want you to be a part of it. I'm bringing together voices from our wandering community to share their favorite passages from J.R.R. Tolkien's works. Here's where you come in. Share with me your most beloved lines from Tolkien and why you love them so much, and I may include your thoughts in episode number 200. So, what is your single most favorite line from Tolkien's tales? Head over to ringspodcast.com/survey to tell me what it is and why you love it so much. You might even be featured in episode number 200. But don't wait, because I need to hear from you by December 31st if you want to be part of episode 200. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/survey. Thank you for joining me in this special celebration. Yeah, I love that you referenced that conversation with Fenrod and the mortal woman. I can't remember her name.
Andreth.
I have not come across Andre. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have not read that story in the history of Middle Earth. It's sitting over my shoulder and it's been sitting there for a long time. I just haven't touched it yet. But I love that you shared that, because I was thinking too as well. One of the main sort of belief systems in any Christian tradition is the fall of man, right? Adam and Eve, one of the first stories in the Bible. And that doesn't really come into the Lord of the Rings or the Silmarillion very much. It's sort of slightly alluded to as sort of men had sort of this dark thing, this dark event in their past that they almost wanted to forget and they were running from, and they started wandering into the West, and that's where they met the elves in the first age of Middle Earth. And it doesn't really come there. And so as you were describing Numenor and sort of that responsibility to sort of recreate or be a launching point for man, I was thinking, well, was that Iluvatar's first attempt to more or less, shall we say, redeem men from the fall? And then it's like, well, that didn't work. Clearly, now I need to become incarnate myself and enter into the world and redeem man with my own interventions. I don't know what you make of that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I will say on the subject of the fall of man, in the same chapter of, and it's actually volume 10 of the History of Middle Earth, Morgoth's Ring. In that same chapter later on, there's a few writings that, you know, Tolkien was notorious for writing these magnificent things that he never finished. You know, they're all kind of part of this one chapter on the Othrabeth. There's actually a, Tolkien's version of the fall of man within that. And it's like, it's almost like kind of a not a ghost story, but like, it's kind of a really creepy, scary story. Like, because, what happens is Morgoth, and he's not named Morgoth, but he presents himself as like this, you know, angel of light who's going to give men what they actually want, right? And so there's a lot of parallels, of course, to the story of Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis. But it's really fascinating that does exist within the legendarium. It's just kind of buried. One of these things is buried.
Yeah. Pretty obscure.
Because Tolkien never finished it. Right. But I think Numenor, I think you're right. I think Numenor is a sort of first attempt. And, you know, of course, the parallels, again, we're not talking allegory, but the parallels with, you know, like, you know, the nation of Israel, the ancient kingdom of Israel, and that kind of thing, you know, can start to stand out when you're like, okay, here's a people that's kind of set apart, drawn apart in order to have a special relationship with the uncreated creator God. And they have points where things are going well in that relationship and with how they behave. And then there's other points at which it's just complete disaster. And they're getting more evil and more evil and more evil, it seems like. And that's the story of Numenor too, right? It's like, you know, just, they have this relationship, and then over time it gets, things just kind of get uglier and uglier within Numenor itself. So I think very much like Numenor has that strong sort of parallel to the kingdom of Israel, the Old Testament stories. And it all does have kind of this, this background. Now that doesn't mean that Tolkien was like, is trying to say like, well, Lord of the Rings then is the gospel story, right? Cause he would never say like Frodo is Christ himself or something like that. Right. But it's actually like what he does seem to have meant is that this is all taking place in a very ancient, like even before the time of like, you know, Israel, right? Like way before that. Right.
Right.
And of course Numenor has roots in Tolkien's fascination with kind of the ancient legends of of Atlantis, right? That's this lost kingdom that may or may not have existed, depending on how deep you want to go into conspiracies and 14 things and all of that kind of stuff. We live in an interesting time when people are always, you know, everybody's got an opinion on such things.
There's plenty of Netflix documentaries to go watch about that stuff.
I think you're spot on with that notion that Numenor is like this first attempt to bring men into like the old, like what their ultimate purpose was. And, and that's one of the things that like, I really love about the juxtaposition of elves and men in Middle Earth, right? I think it's such a brilliant, sort of a brilliant scheme, you know, to use for storytelling, because you have this inherent question in the whole story of like people that get to live forever in this world, right? They don't age. They do actually age, but it's like in accordance with the age of the world. So it's like, but their lifespan is the lifespan of Arda itself, of the world itself. And that's elves, right? They're immortal as long as Arda exists. And then you have men, and it's like, yeah, you're like, you enter in this world as a man. And you're like, well, why did I draw the short straw? Right? Like why can't I live in that world? And of course, Tolkien has said all kinds of brilliant things about the role that, you know, how death is really a gift, you know, in his view, and that accords very much, with his Catholic faith. But of course, it's only a gift insofar as, one has the resurrection hope, right? And of course, yes. that's all very, rooted in Catholicism and Christianity as well. So.
Yeah, I love, there's so much to unpack and react to there. And you just brought up the idea of the resurrection. And I'm reminded of this line from On Fairy Stories, which was a speech that Tolkien gave and later was printed as an essay. And sort of he outlined the principles of what makes a really good story. And in that, he sort of defined his term of a eucatastrophe. Mm-hmm. Which if you are a listener of Lord of the Rings podcast, we've covered this before, but just as a reminder that eucatastrophe is that sudden joyous turn, in all darkness, in all despair, when all hope is lost, there's all of a sudden that sudden joyous turn. It's not exactly a Deus Ex Machina device, but it is more of a has to be set up, but it is that sudden joyous turn. And Tolkien in On Fairy Stories, he said this, quote, "The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits." What do you make of that, John?
That's everything. I mean, I think when I read that, you know, who knows when the first time I read that was, but I think. You know, I think I'd sensed from reading Lord of the Rings and that kind of thing, just, you know, what, like there was just something really, really special about these stories that got deep into my soul. And then when I read that, I'm like, okay, there it is. Like that's what this guy is getting at. And I think from there, that's how I wound up doing 10 years worth of podcasting on Tolkien, you know, like after kind of putting all of that together. Yeah, I think that, of course, he wrote that in the late 30s, just as he was beginning just during this time period when he was beginning to come up with the story of Numenor as a separate thing. And then he was beginning to write The New Hobbit, right, which eventually became Lord of the Rings after over a decade of work. But that was at the inception of both of those things that he kind of made that observation, came up with those ideas, and he's kind of like writing this literary manifesto, right, about what he really views as the key to like great fantasy literature. And so it's interesting that happens at the very beginning of this long journey that happened to coincide with World War II, right, this great cataclysm of the middle of the 20th century, along with writing this, you know, the composing The Legend of Numenor and writing Lord of the Rings. And of course, Numenor was eventually folded into the legendarium of Middle Earth. But yeah, I think, you know, again, like the he's writing Lord of the Rings unconsciously, and then he like gets to the, you know, close to the end, and he's like, okay, you know, maybe a year or two away from publishing it. And he's like reading back on all the drafts, editing and everything. And he's like, well, I guess all the Catholicism is just in there. And now I want to spend the rest of my life like unpacking all of this. And of course there's so many, you know, there's so many other details. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, the March 25th thing, right? Which is just really one of the clearest indications, right, of what he means by this whole it's not intentional, but this is almost like it is kind of intentional though, right? because
to get into that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So the March 25th thing. March 25th is the day that the ring is destroyed, right? The day that won't go into all the details, but the ring is destroyed on March 25th. March 25th mm-hmm. happens to be happens to coincide with the feast, the Catholic feast of the Annunciation in terms of the calendar, which of course is the moment of the Incarnation, right? That is when the Incarnation occurred. So the Annunciation being the angel Gabriel appears to the Virgin Mary and greets her and announces that she will be the one to bear the Messiah, right? To bear Christ. And so, you know, it's that moment when she says, when she gives her fiat, right? When she says, you know, thy will be done, that Christ becomes flesh, that the Son of God becomes flesh. So March 25th being that same date, the ring is destroyed on that date. Depending on which year you're in and the liturgical calendar, it can also be the date of the crucifixion or the resurrection, right? So there, it's possible that it would align with any of those dates as well. So you get it all packed right in there. So it's almost like Tolkien was like, I'm going to make one thing really on the nose right here. Right. Maybe that's part of the, you know, consciously in the revision part of it. It's like, let's try to line these dates up so the March 25th works out there. So, but you know, that I think he's very, very much trying to say like, there is a, this takes place as a mythology in this world, and it's supposed to have a deep connection to what he viewed as the central, the turning point in the history of our world, the great eucatastrophe of the history of our world, which was the Incarnation of Christ, which leads into, and the eucatastrophe of Christ's story is the passion, right? The death and resurrection.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
My fellow wanderer, we are fast approaching the 200th episode of the Lore of the Rings podcast, and I want you to be a part of it. I'm bringing together voices from our wandering community to share their favorite passages from J.R.R. Tolkien's works. Here's where you come in. Share with me your most beloved lines from Tolkien and why you love them so much, and I may include your thoughts in episode number 200. So, what is your single most favorite line from Tolkien's tales? Head over to ringspodcast.com/survey to tell me what it is and why you love it so much. You might even be featured in episode number 200. But don't wait, because I need to hear from you by December 31st if you want to be part of episode 200. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/survey. Thank you for joining me in this special celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Thanks for explaining that March 25th thing. I'm a Christian believer as well, but not quite of the Catholic tradition. And so little details like that are like, oh man, that just blows my mind that he's thinking about that. And he's so detailed in his timelines that here's the one thing that that the timeline is going to line up on. So that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
I do have one final question for you, John. But before we do that, I would like to give you a moment to invite any Lord of the Rings listener to kind of hear what the Tolkien Road podcast is all about.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. We have just been on this almost 10-year journey now through kind of chapter by chapter reads of Tolkien's various works. We've done a lot of other things along the way as well. We started out way back a long time ago, reading through the Silmarillion one chapter at a time. We've actually done that twice now. We read through Lord of the Rings. And at this point, we're on a very, very long, insane journey trying to do like the slowest possible read through the Lord of the Rings and actually make it through in one life.
Be hasty.
Right. Do not be hasty. We're a little bit on a kind of taking things super slow right now, kind of been a little radio quiet for a little while as of late, just a lot going on in life. But, you know, again, we're not on a, the whole do not be hasty thing comes from Treebeard, of course, in the Lord of the Rings, right? Do not be hasty, right? Trying to use that as a mantra, for the rest of our lives. But we just think, I say we, of course, along with my wife, Greta, we have a deep love for Tolkien. I'm of the persuasion. I just kind of hang on every word he says, and his words have meant so much for me in the course of my lifetime, have really, given me a lot of direction, and clarity and purpose in dark times. And so, you know, we're just trying to, take our time going through all of it, because it's, Lord of the Rings is just one of those books where it's like all of the little details add up and they matter, and, they're worth exploring. So, that's where we are right now on the journey. And you know, we'll probably take some time along the way to dive into, you know, some of the other works. We haven't actually done our read through Othrebeth, the previously mentioned Othrebeth, yet. But, and then sometimes we'll take some time and, you know, discuss one of the letters or a passage from one of the letters. And then I've got a YouTube channel too, where from time to time I'll post kind of shorter form topical videos. You know, I really love, I tell people all the time, I didn't get into Tolkien because I'm like a big fantasy, you know, fantasy fan. I got into Tolkien because of the more philosophical side of it. So I'm not really a Dungeons and Dragons guy. I am like, I just love Tolkien's way of looking at the world, and I can't get enough of it. So that's where I'm coming from with the Tolkien Road. And, I have written a couple of books. I'm working on a third and a fourth one right now. Who knows when they'll be out, but, I have a book on the story of Tolkien, of Beren and Lúthien, which is called Tolkien's Requiem. Very short read, yes. Kind of meant to be an easy way to get into the Silmarillion for those who are challenged by the front door start. And then another book on called Tolkien's Overture, which is about the music of the Ainur, the creation story of Middle Earth, and how music is almost like the fabric of Middle Earth itself, and it kind of uses that story to explain how that is.
Oh yeah, well that's several podcast episodes content worth just in that little idea right there. Yes, thank you, John, and I. As I said, I've been a longtime listener of your podcast. I love the depth and the shall we say the reverence that you bring to Tolkien's works, and Greta as well. It just brings really piercing insights as almost I don't know what the right word is, but almost just the beginner level. Not she's not beginner, but she's able to really just ask those questions that are so good for everybody that they need to hear, You two play off each other really well.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. It's been a great journey. It's crazy to think we've been at it for almost 10 years, and our kids have, it's like when we first started doing it, our kids were a lot younger. So it was easier to carve out the time, to do it. But, now they're older, and somehow I thought when they were 10 years ago, when they were a lot younger, I thought, well, we'll have a lot more time when they're older. And it's like, actually, no, you have more, you need to devote more time to them at that point. So, anyway, it's all, it's been a great journey, and you're right. Greta is nowhere near the Tolkien nerd that I am, but, that's what makes it fun is she does love Tolkien, and she can bring, you know, great questions to the table because she's not way down in the weeds, with so much of it like I am.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let's wrap this up here, and I don't know quite how to articulate this question, and maybe it'll come to me. But you've said yourself in the course of this conversation in a number of different ways, Tolkien's works have moved you so deeply. Things have resonated with you, and And that really touches me as well, because you can see over one shoulder, I've got all my Tolkien books, and then over my other shoulder, I've got scripture, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's like, I'm going to go read the Word of God, and then I'm going to go read Tolkien. It's not to say that Tolkien is essentially scripture, but it's a great cousin to reading the Word of God. And I myself have personally been moved and had my life changed and been inspired by Tolkien and his words and his characters and his philosophy. Like it's a wonder to me, right? Mm-hmm. The way that he was able to bring these ideas to life. So I guess the question I want to ask you is, given Tolkien's work, his stories, given the religious and Catholic foundation of those stories, how have his works changed your life?
Yeah, it's such a massive question for me. I think his works have just given me the ability to see things in a much more realistic but hopeful way. And I don't mean realistic in the sense of like sort of like materialistic output or outlook. But I mean like that, not to look at this world through the lens of like of materialism, or to look at it in a sort of despairing way. But even in the darkest of times, to understand like, you know, there's hope. There's the great line that Sam, you know, when Sam is, you know, deep into Mordor with Frodo, and he has that realization, he sees the star twinkling above him in this, you know, forsaken land. And he has the realization that the shadow is only a passing thing. And that, of course, that makes me think of Psalm 23, right? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you're with me, right? I think that may be the best summary. It's been wonderful because, again, like just knowing how beloved this story is, and it just stands above everything. It somehow still stands above everything, and you understand why, and to know that rooted in it is this ultimate great hope, this unfailing, powerful hope that believes that death is not the end, but that everything sad will come untrue again, as Sam says, right? I mean, that can get you through anything, right? That can get you through anything. And it also is something that you want to help other people see. And so it can become not just something for yourself, you know, kind of a your own little private Numenor, if you will, but it can become something that you want to ultimately share with others and to help others see the star beyond the shadow, right? Beyond the shadow, mm-hmm. and to understand that the shadow is a passing thing. You know, I think that's probably the ultimate way I would put it there. So much more I could say about that question, Aaron. I think Tolkien's theory of like subcreation and like what that means as far as human creativity, bakes into it so much as well. But I think you're asking for kind of a shorter answer, so I won't go into all of that too much.
Well, I think that answer is perfect, and I think it's a great way to wrap up. And it reminds me of a line from one of Tolkien's letters where he was in, I think it was World War I, and he received a letter from a friend of his notifying him that another friend of his had died in battle or in some way connected to World War I. And they were really tight. It was one of these societies that Tolkien was always creating. It was, you know, three or four of his best friends. And, you know, he goes on to say that their intent in that little group was to, I'm going to bosh it here, but their intent was to kindle a new light or rekindle an old one with mm-hmm. their works of literature, with the writing, with the work of their life that they were going to pursue. And, you know, as you say, you describe hope that comes and the star that Sam sees. You know, there's light and beauty far above the darkness. I would say, Colton, I would say that Tolkien nailed it.
Yeah.
Nailed it. You have kindled the light for us, rekindled an old light within us. And so I really love that you and Greta and myself, that we have this opportunity to try to share that light and try to share that hope with others that we have found through the Lord of the Rings.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, John, thank you so much for wandering Middle Earth with me today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Aaron. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
My fellow wanderer, we are fast approaching the 200th episode of the Lore of the Rings podcast, and I want you to be a part of it. I'm bringing together voices from our wandering community to share their favorite passages from J.R.R. Tolkien's works. Here's where you come in. Share with me your most beloved lines from Tolkien and why you love them so much, and I may include your thoughts in episode number 200. So, what is your single most favorite line from Tolkien's tales? Head over to ringspodcast.com/survey to tell me what it is and why you love it so much. You might even be featured in episode number 200. But don't wait, because I need to hear from you by December 31st if you want to be part of episode 200. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/survey. Thank you for joining me in this special celebration.